Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. You know, the prognosis for many cancers has improved due to many factors, including a better understanding of cancer in general, earlier detection, and better treatment. And often the treatment has been coming better and better with even fewer side effects. The use of ionizing radiation for certain cancers is one of these improvements. And today, with the help of Dr. Larry Daugherty, who is a radiation oncologist at the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center here in Anchorage, we're going to examine how radiotherapy aids the treatment of cancer. And we'll also learn about a nonprofit organization he started during his residency called Radiating Hope, which is working to improve cancer care globally. Dr. Daugherty came to us about 2 years ago. Not too long ago. You have to remind me how long.
August.
From after 2 years at the Mayo Clinic.
Correct.
He did some training both at the Mayo Clinic and at Drexel University in radiation oncology. Then spent 2 years with the Mayo before coming up here. So welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Let me remind listeners that anytime during this program, you're free to give us a call or drop us an email about questions or comments. The way to do that is 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number also, 1-888-353-5752. And an email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. Dr. Daugherty, tell us a little bit about yourself. I like to have a little bit of personal stuff in here, especially when we're going to talk about something as nasty as cancer.
You bet. Thanks again for having me today. So a little bit about me. I grew up in the Seattle area in a large family. I had seven sisters, and I've managed to keep that tradition alive by having a large family myself. So I'm married. I have five kids, three boys and two girls. And as you mentioned in the opener, we moved here, live in Eagle River, moved here in August of last year. So I'm a radiation oncologist by trade, and I'm also an avid mountain climber. In fact, I'm preparing to climb Denali next month. And I really fully embraced all that Alaska has to offer by also qualifying for the Iditarod, which I plan to do next year.
Oh, no, you're not one of those guys. Really?
Yeah.
So you got sled dogs, or you use somebody else's?
I've partnered with Jim Lanier.
Yeah?
Former pathologist at Providence Hospital. He has a large kennel in Chugiak. And he was nice enough to train me and let me use his dogs for my qualifying races this year.
Well, good luck with that.
Appreciate that.
So how'd you get interested in radiation oncology then?
Yeah, so it's a good question. I stumbled across radiation oncology quite by accident, actually. My first career was as a paramedic and a firefighter, which I did for 10 years, and just found during my third-year rotations in medical school that I really enjoyed the interactions with cancer patients, and had a friend who was very interested in radiation oncology and pointed me in that direction, and I just instantly fell in love with the field. I think one of the things that fascinated me the most, aside from the interactions with the patients, was the technology, and I'm sure we'll talk a lot today about the exciting technology.
Mm-hmm. And when I think of radiation oncologists, I think you must have been really enamored with physics, but maybe that's not necessarily true.
In my case, it definitely was not. In fact, as an undergraduate, I can remember not really enjoying my physics classes.
Me too.
The application of that, though, has really helped me to fall in deeper love with physics, I guess.
All right. So maybe our listeners don't necessarily understand the full scope of the word radiation oncology anyway. So let's take a second and describe not only what you do, but what others might be doing in radiation oncology.
Yeah, you bet. So radiation oncology is one of what I would call the three pillars of cancer care. I think many patients are probably familiar with surgical oncology, where obviously you remove a tumor with surgery, and there are those that specialize as surgeons specifically in oncologic surgeries. The second pillar really would be medical oncologists or hematologists, hematology oncologists, who prescribe medical therapies such as chemotherapy or other drugs to treat cancer. The third pillar is a bit more nebulous to patients and also, quite frankly, even and to my colleagues in the medical community, radiation oncology is a very small field of medicine, tends to kind of be the black box that many people don't understand. But it simply speaking is the application of radiation to treat cancer, much in the way that a surgeon would wield their scalpel or a medical oncologist would prescribe a drug. I prescribe radiation.
And yeah, I think it is surprising because in what I read in kind of prepping for this is that of all the patients who have cancer, almost one half, it's the sole treatment. And yet I think of it as an adjunct most of the time, showing you where I'm coming from.
Yeah. In talking about cancer therapies, sometimes one therapy, be it surgery or chemotherapy or radiation, is quote unquote more important than another therapy. Take breast cancer, for instance. That's something most people are familiar with. Surgical removal of the tumor would be what we would call the definitive or the curative therapy. Radiation is given as an adjunct or adjuvant or helper treatment to sterilize any microscopic disease that might be left behind at the time of surgery. But you're absolutely right. Radiation has become more and more important, particularly as the technology to safely deliver radiation has dramatically improved. And many times radiation is that important curative or definitive treatment option in lieu of either surgery or chemotherapy.
Okay. As we move along, perhaps we can talk about how you decide which ones of these modalities are the best ones to be used. But I want to stick with a little sequence here because I love to hear about what you're doing and to learn that it's I need to know more about it. But I also like to know a little bit about the history. Where does this come from? When was it started? How has it changed? Where are we going with this?
Yeah, so, radiation really was discovered in the late 1890s. Maybe it's helpful, too, if we define what radiation is. I think that word is nebulous to a lot of people. So radiation, simply speaking, is energy, and it's energy that is emitted by atoms that comes in a spectrum. So we know that some of this energy is more energetic than others, and radiation really is, it's all around us. Energy or radiation emanates from the sun. It's in some of the foods that we eat. It's in some of the water that we drink. It emanates from the earth. And there's really two defining spectrums of radiation. There's what we call non-ionizing radiation, such as comes from your cell phone or the lights that are here in the studio. And then there's ionizing radiation, which is the more powerful radiation, which is the type of radiation that is used in medical applications. So radiation was discovered in the 1890s. That's when the first X-rays were taken and really took hold immediately in the early 1900s as a form of cancer treatment.
And it does have a little bit of a speckled history in that some of the original researchers, as I recall, and one of which, who I think Madame Curie won two Nobel Prizes, she eventually died of consequences. So there's this bother that originates back from the discovery.
Yeah, many of the important early researchers unfortunately died of radiation exposure, and that was because, while radiation was instantly seen as a potential therapeutic modality, we didn't have a way to really measure the radiation. We didn't have a way to safely shield and direct the beam of radiation to deliver it in a targeted fashion, and we didn't really realize that there could be bystander effects until a good 10 to 20 years into the application of radiation. I'll give you one kind of interesting study that was done in the early 1900s, and that was radiation was delivered to, believe it or not, ram testicles. And the ram testicles were seen as kind of a surrogate for tumors. You can think of the cells that produce semen. They divide very rapidly, and that was a surrogate for a tumor that could divide very rapidly. And there was an experiment done where the radiation was either given in one high-dose treatment or it was fractionated, meaning small amounts of radiation were given every day. And it's really interesting, the results of this experiment. When the radiation was given in one treatment with a large dose, the skin around the testicles was burned, and at the same time the cells within were also damaged, the surrogate for cancer damage. Whereas when the treatment was broken up into small amounts of radiation given every day, There was an ability to spare the skin, but at the same time cause the same effect deeper into the tissue. That was one of the foundational studies for fractionating radiation treatments.
So that was back when we're still medical science, physicists, everybody, we're still trying to figure out what was going on, how to determine the safety, mm-hmm. how to see the best effect. Which is what happens with all medical treatments. You're looking at what's the risk-benefit, and you're trying to understand what's going on and seeing the side effects.
Yeah, exactly.
So why did the skin and the scrotum get injured?
Well, there's a in radiation oncology today, we take advantage of normal tissue dynamics that are not there within tumor cells. So tumor cells are not very good at repairing themselves from damage from radiation versus normal tissue can. So that's essentially why when you give a small amount of dose to normal tissues, they can repair and recover versus tumor cells cannot do that.
This is getting off the subject maybe a little deep for people, but I know like the BRCA genes are the genes that women who have a lack of these genes, they have an abnormality in these genes. Those genes make proteins that clean up the mistakes that are being made with DNA. Their listeners may not understand that all the time we are having problems because we make billions and trillions of reproductions of DNA, and no matter how good we are, we make mistakes, and those mistakes can lead to problems. But we also have evolved the ability to fix those things. That's what I hear you saying.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So at the molecular level, there are oncogenes that when they mutate, they impact our ability. Basically, they put the foot on the gas pedal in terms of being able to really stimulate cell division and tumor growth. And then we have tumor suppressor genes that are responsible for suppressing the development of cancer, and that you can think of that as the brake pedal. So in either an oncogene or a tumor suppressor gene is mutated, either of those can lead to the development of uncontrolled cancer.
Let me just take 1 second to remind listeners, my guest today is Dr. Larry Daugherty. He's a radiation oncologist at the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center here in Anchorage. And what we're doing is we're trying to understand radiation therapy for cancer. And if you've got questions or comments about anything you hear today, there's a couple of ways to get a hold of us while we're both in the studio. Our local phone number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. So you've already mentioned some general principles of radiation therapy. Are there other general ideas or general concepts with which you guys practice?
Yeah, I think in terms of being able to deliver radiation safely, really the three principles that to us are the most important are time, distance, and shielding. So the amount of time that someone is exposed to radiation, the distance to that radiation source, and then our ability to be able to safely shield. So our ability to be able to see the tumor with advanced imaging and to be able to target the area that we want to treat, and at the same time spare normal tissues around it. Those are some of the major advances in radiation therapy.
Are there different kinds of radiation therapy? I don't want to get too detailed here, but I think of sometimes injecting things or placing things in the body that may have radiation that I've heard about. And then there are beams of radiation that are administered. It must be much more complex than that.
Well, some yes and some no. I would say, over 100 years ago, the main application of radiation was what we call brachytherapy. So actual live radioactive source. You can think of, uranium rock or a radium rod that would be applied close to the tumor. Certainly you can think of some safety concerns to the staff that would be applying that radiation close to the tumor, but that was kind of the primitive development of radiation. Nowadays, the vast majority of radiation is delivered with machines called linear accelerators. So these machines can shape the radiation beam, and they can deliver a high energy of radiation that can spare normal tissue and treat the tumor. Over the last couple of decades, I would say that the evolution of radiation oncology has gone from two-dimensional therapy to three-dimensional therapy. So, you know, 20 years ago, we would put tattoos on a patient's skin. Take breast cancer as an example. We could feel the lump in the breast. We could see where the abnormality was, and we would perhaps in the head of the machine where this radiation emanates from, we could sculpt the beam with different metal plates that we would actually construct and place to shape the beam. But nowadays, instead of lining up just to a patient's anatomy or tattoo marks that we might put on the skin, we can actually see the tumor itself. We can get a CAT scan of sorts with the same machine that is going to deliver the radiation. So we can line the patient up. We can see the tumor in three dimensions. We can see the anatomy in three dimensions, and we can deliver a very conformal treatment as a result.
I know one of the advances that you've brought, at least to the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center, is what's called true beam mechanisms or technology. Could you, I guess that's what you're telling us right now. Can you refine that maybe a little bit better? Is that's the latest, I get the feeling from what my reading about what's available.
Yeah, you know, it's a really exciting treatment. I think that a lot of folks may not be aware that we have the latest, greatest technology here in Alaska, and there's really no need to go to the lower 48, at least for radiation treatment anymore. There's no better technology available anywhere than what is available with the TrueBeam. I'll tell you a little bit about some of the advancements with the TrueBeam. One is the ability to shape the beam. So I mentioned in the head of the machine, we have these finger-like projections that we call collimators. You can think of them as little lead leaflets that are very tiny and allow us to shape the beam around an area that around our target. So older machines, the width of each one of these little fingerlet-like projections was a centimeter. With the TrueBeam, it's 2.5 millimeters. So it's kind of thinking of a standard definition television set versus a high definition television set in our ability to really conformally sculpt the beam. Other advances have been the speed of treatment delivery. So a treatment that used to take 15 or 20 minutes now only takes 2 minutes or less. And that has implications not just for patient convenience, having a rapid treatment, but when we take such great time and effort and care to line a patient up very, very precisely, say your target is the prostate with a bladder that is nearby and a rectum that is nearby. Well, if it takes a half an hour to deliver a treatment and you're basing your treatment off of, you know, some initial images that you got, you can imagine that over a half an hour, the volume of the bladder might change, right? It might fill up with urine, or you could have a gas bubble that goes into the rectum, and that can really impact your treatment delivery. So the speed which we deliver the radiation treatment is very important. So we have a very conformal treatment that's delivered very, very quickly. I think those are some of the main advances with the TrueBeam.
Do we know if the TrueBeam is perhaps safer? And I use safer in the big sense of things. As you implied, it seems like there's less chance for movement, which so you'd have less ancillary kinds of potential for damage and so forth. Is that true? And are there other potential safety advantages?
Well, I think when you look at dosimetric studies, those are studies that look at how much dose is delivered to normal tissue with the TrueBeam compared to, say, an older linear accelerator. You look at dosimetric studies like that, and there's a clear decrease in the amount of radiation dose that goes to tissues like the heart, the bladder, the rectum, depending on your area of interest. I don't think that we have data yet that says, yes, clearly the TrueBeam results in better cure rates or less toxicity from a clinical standpoint. But I would say, well, if it's treating less normal tissue, that extra dose to the of radiation to normal tissues is never going to be a good thing, right? You'd never want to get that. And we do have long-term studies, particularly in the breast literature, that show that even small doses of radiation to normal tissues like the heart can have a very clinically important, meaningful outcome later in life. So I do think that some of that data is really emerging.
But you're going to have to help me on this because I was also under the impression of something I read that sometimes you want some peripheral tissues involved because there may be some malignant cells spreading into that. That makes sense, but at the same time, you don't want to you don't want to injure too much normal tissue. So how do you rationalize what you're trying to do with that idea?
Excellent question. And I think that's part of why it takes so long to become a radiation oncologist. Some of these things are clinical judgments that are made. If you look at a CAT scan and you see a tumor in the lung, you're absolutely right. What we see isn't always the end of the picture. There can be an amount of microscopic tumor that is right around the main tumor that we can see. And so every radiation oncologist with any type of technology is going to account for that. There's what we call a microscopic margin or a clinical tumor volume margin that is added on to the amount of disease that we can see. What I'm really talking about is not that microscopic margin, but in saying, this is the target that I want to hit, inclusive of that microscopic amount of disease.
Gotcha.
This spillover to the normal tissues above and beyond that is what can be limited with modern technology.
With what we know about cancers now, is the microscopic margin different but depending on the cancer? Or is that pretty, well, just no, there's a general rule?
No, it absolutely is. And it also, there are some newer imaging modalities that can help us really better define the extent of disease. I think in terms of a PET scan, for instance, these metabolic studies that show us more information than just a CAT scan or an MRI or an X-ray. Oftentimes, when we're applying radiation, I use more than just one study to figure out where the disease can be. And you have to be a bit of a detective and also have an understanding of the natural history of the given disease. To understand, for instance, that a lung cancer would spread, from the lung to the lymph nodes in the center of the chest, which lymph nodes would it likely involve? Having that intimate understanding of each different disease type really helps you design your radiation treatment field.
I think... again, in general, I tell my patients sometimes when I'm thinking about different illnesses or problems, I'm thinking about just different people that I might recognize going on. They're each are different, and absolutely the same thing is true about cancer. They have different personalities. They have different ways of doing things.
Yeah. Unfortunately, some of them break the rules, and those are some of the more challenging cancers to treat.
We have a couple of emails that are specifically designed to questions about specific problems, but I'd like to go ahead and do those before our break if I can get through both of these, and then we'll keep going about understanding a little bit more about what you're doing and as well as spreading into some information about specific questions people have. So this is an email. It says, in 1982, I had a lumpectomy that was in Boston and was treated with external linear beam treatment, I guess, after the lumpectomy, along with radiation seeds threaded through my breast for a predetermined period of time. So it was 1982. The cancer returned pathologically to the same breast in 1992, 10 years afterwards, and was treated surgically with a partial mastectomy without clear margins, it says. I declined chemotherapy, and in 2002, again 10 more years later, the cancer returned, and I had both breasts removed. I've been told that should the cancer return, I would not be eligible for radiation treatment. Is that true?
Very, very interesting question. So here we have a patient who has a history of radiation exposure to the chest. Would she 30 years later now be eligible for re-irradiation to that same area? I think that historically the answer to that used to be absolutely not. But now I think the answer to that is maybe. It really depends on where the cancer comes back, how extensive it comes back. But our ability to be able to safely re-irradiate tissues has improved dramatically. And sometimes if, surgery is not an option or further chemotherapy or systemic agents are not an option and our backs are against the wall, we are safely able to re-irradiate areas.
So was the risk that you're going to increase the likelihood of cancer due to treatment, that you're going to cause more substantial injury? What are the reasons why in the past it's been not recommended?
We worry that those tissues that saw radiation before still kind of remember their radiation dose, so to speak, and that they can be even more susceptible to radiation damage. So we still don't like to re-irradiate, but it depends on, what dose of radiation was received before and what would the new volume of radiation be in order to make that determination.
So to me, in the big picture, that gets back to something I talk about all the time. What's the risk of treatment? What's the risk of not treatment? And those are the important questions about anything, not just what's the risk of treatment. Sometimes you get your back against the wall and there's not many other options, and the best option is one that's got some risk.
That's exactly right. I mean, if you have a tumor that cannot be removed surgically and the tumor is going to cause normal tissue destruction, it's bleeding, it's ulcerating, it's painful, and it's going to continue to grow out of control, well, certainly that, you know, the risk of radiation compared to the risk of the tumor continuing to spread, well, the therapeutic ratio, I think, would swing in favor of radiation.
All right. Second question that I've gotten is, when is radiation not indicated? What is the evidence that radiation is needed when a woman has had a lumpectomy with discrete borders and no evidence that it is spread? I'm not sure I follow that. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, I think so. It sounds like the patient has a very specific question about breast cancer. So after a lumpectomy, are there times where radiation would not be indicated in breast cancer? And I think that the answer to that, by and large, is that's an active area of study. You know, back in the 70s and 80s, every patient with breast cancer, whether they had a teeny tiny non-invasive breast cancer or a very large breast cancer, they were all given the same treatment, and that was a mastectomy. And it was really women who pushed for this to change. And as a result, there were large studies that looked at more conservative surgery, just removing the tumor, what we call lumpectomy, versus mastectomy. And what we saw that a lumpectomy alone is not sufficient treatment. Up to 40% of patients recur with a lumpectomy alone. When you add radiation to a lumpectomy, then the rates of recurrence, the rates of cancer control, the rates of dying of breast cancer, all of that falls down to the same rates that you would see with a mastectomy. So basically, nowadays, a lumpectomy and radiation is equivalent to a mastectomy. So
with outcome, for outcome.
Yes, exactly. So I think her question is, you know, well, if 40% of patients recur that with a lumpectomy alone, that's not 100%.
Right.
Who are the 60% of patients who, you know, don't recur? And we don't know the answer to that question yet. And I think that we are getting better and better at being able to tailor our therapy. But right now, the risk is high enough that every woman with a lumpectomy is a part of that treatment. Usually they get radiation.
So to follow on the idea that what's the risk of doing something, what's the risk of not, in this particular woman, or if I'm putting myself in her place and I'm asking myself, I have specific issues. What's my family history? What's my genetics? You know, what's my risks of getting the treatment? So for each person individually, they have to weigh these risk-benefit ratios. What's the risk of doing it? What's the risk not doing it? In general, most women, I hear you saying now, it's recommended to go ahead and get the radiation therapy.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Thanks very much.
Yeah, you bet.
We are going to take a short break. We're already halfway through this program. Let me remind everyone you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. If you've got questions or comments, our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433, toll-free 1-888-353-5752. Our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll continue our discussion of the use of ionizing radiation to treat cancers with Dr. Larry Doherty. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1, Your Health Connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection from KSKA Anchorage, and I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking about radiation therapy of cancer with Dr. Larry Daugherty. Dr. Daugherty is radiation oncologist at the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center here in Anchorage. If you have questions or comments, we have about 30 more minutes that we'll be here. Our local number is 550-8433, 550-8433. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org, and you need to spell out a line one, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all is one word. And also we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And just remember, as you just heard, we're here right now, and then later tonight, there's a repeat of this program, which is a recording between 9 and 10, and we won't be able to answer your questions at that time. However, if you have questions or you want to refer someone to listen to this program, you can just send them to alaskapublic.org, ask them to look for the Line 1 link, and our archives will be there. The program, this program comes up pretty quickly on that website, so you can listen again or refer someone to listen to the program. Let's go through this a little bit more and about how this radiation is killing cancer cells. Is it the only way it works is by affecting DNA, and then as that DNA is destroyed, the cell kind of just naturally dies and the products are then removed? Is that basically, it's that simple?
I can tell you've done your homework there, Thad. Yeah, that's basically the basic principle is, yes, the DNA interacts either directly with the DNA, damages the DNA to the point that cells cannot divide and thus die, or the radiation can interact with basically water inside the cell, and that interaction can cause other byproducts that then interact with the DNA. But the ultimate end result, yes, is DNA damage.
We've spoken a little bit about risks and benefits, and I'm sure somebody out there listening must want to know, as I do, what's the cancer risk long-term from radiation therapy? And I'm already going to guess that can be difficult, because I think it's already known that if you've had one cancer, your risk already goes up a little bit. So answering the question is, what's the cause and what's the effect if you have another cancer, can be difficult. What do we know about risks and benefit? Well, we know about benefit. What are the risks, long-term, short-term?
I'm glad you asked that, Thad, because it's a question I get all the time. I think, you know, radiation has a bad rap for that. We certainly don't want to live next to nuclear power plants, and we know that radiation exposure over our lifetime can produce harm. It's interesting, though, my medical oncology colleagues, I don't think, are asked very commonly, how common is it that the chemotherapy is going to cause another cancer in my lifetime? But really, if you look at the numbers, it's kind of the same risk, and the risk is really small, but when it's kind of the risk-benefit thing that you were touching on earlier. To answer your question, with radiation, it's really age-dependent. We know that the risk of a radiation-induced cancer will increase substantially, inversely proportional to age. So younger patients, when possible, you know, we really don't like to radiate those patients unless radiation is absolutely needed and judged to be more beneficial than the potential harm of inducing a cancer. Even in those instances, though, it's not like a cancer is guaranteed as a result of delivering radiation. The risk might be as high as 10 or 15% over the course of a young patient's life. But when you're looking at any patient over the age of 30, the risk of cancer is very, very small. You're talking about maybe a 1 in 1,000 chance that decades later a radiation-associated cancer can form. So the fact of the matter is, most patients who are diagnosed with cancer are diagnosed, later in life, in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and the risk to those patients of having a radiation-associated cancer, since it does take decades to develop, is so close to zero that you can almost say zero, but it's not zero.
What are the other significant side effects that we may not have thought to ask about?
Yeah, you bet. So, you know, the side effects of radiation always depend on where we are aiming the radiation. Oftentimes when a patient comes in to see me, I think that they think of radiation more like chemotherapy, which is a systemic treatment where you might lose your hair and get sick to your stomach and have nausea or vomiting. You know, radiation very, very uncommonly would cause those sorts of side effects. You can think of radiation almost more like you would think of surgery. So in the same way that a surgeon might leave a scar behind and cause some local tenderness or local side effects as a result of surgery, radiation is much the same. So, you know, it all depends on where I'm aiming the radiation. If I was aiming it at a woman's breast, for instance, she might see some reddening of the skin. She might have a little bit of pain or tenderness in the breast. But 9 times out of 10, there's really nothing above and beyond that in terms of side effects from radiation.
Okay. All right. We have a caller. I want to take that phone call. Sarah, you're on line one.
I just had a question about a friend of mine is waiting for a biopsy, and we're wondering if radiation is the only option, or is it the last option?
So you're talking about a breast cancer biopsy?
Yeah.
Okay.
So your friend is awaiting results of a biopsy that may or may not be cancer. Is that right?
Yeah.
Well, broadly speaking, and you know, there are lots of nuances when it comes to really giving a treatment recommendation. So she should be seen by a comprehensive team of oncologists, you know, a surgeon, a radiation oncologist, and a medical oncologist. But broadly speaking, there are two acceptable treatments for breast cancer, at least for management of the breast itself. And that is a mastectomy, meaning removal of the breast, or a lumpectomy, which would then be followed by radiation. Most women nowadays, you know, understandably would like to keep their natural breast. So women who opt for a lumpectomy almost always would be recommended as a part of that treatment radiation.
Okay, so if you're just going to get a mastectomy, you don't need radiation?
Not always. I would say most of the time, radiation is not necessary if a woman has a mastectomy. But there are cases, such as if the cancer had spread to the lymph nodes, or if the surgeon was unable to remove all of the cancer, leaving part of the cancer behind, or if the cancer was large. There are certain indications for what we call post-mastectomy radiation. But most of the time, a mastectomy is an acceptable treatment for cancer, but it's just not a necessary one, and to be able to hang on to your natural breast, you know, is an attractive option for most women.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Well, let's hope the biopsy is negative.
Absolutely.
Hey, good luck, Sarah. We've only spoken about breast cancer so far, as if there's no other cancers out there and there's nothing else that we need to be doing. I'm sure that's not the case.
Yeah. You know, radiation is used in about 2/3 of treatment of all cancers. It's not used very commonly in what we call liquid cancers, you know, leukemias. Sometimes lymphomas can be treated with chemotherapy alone. But most solid tumors, radiation is a component of their care. One of the really impressive things about new technology with radiation is that the ability for radiation to be used as the definitive treatment, like we were talking about earlier, has really skyrocketed. There are applications of radiation that you can think of more like surgery now, where you're delivering very high doses of radiation, and we call it actually stereotactic radiosurgery, where we're giving very high doses of radiation to, say, a lung tumor, and that is all of the treatment that is needed, and it can be delivered in, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 treatments, you know, non-invasively with literally no acute side effects.
Wow. So that raises it raises the comment that I think I want to ask, and that is that we're beginning to talk about significant cures of cancer, and you haven't used that word, and I know physicians are hesitant because mm-hmm. it can be difficult to define, although we use definitions, but that's what we mean, and what the patient is hoping for is different. So Where is the radiation therapy most effective, where we're most likely to truly get a cure?
Radiation all by itself?
Yeah.
You know, that's a really interesting question, and I can't remember which old school radiation researcher said this, but it was once said that any cancer could be quote unquote cured if you could give it a high enough dose of radiation. And at my core, I really do believe that. We've seen that to be true, that as our ability to be able to escalate the dose of radiation safely without giving a lot of bystander dose, we can control the most resistant of cancers as long as we're dealing with cancer that has not spread, anywhere outside of the local tumor. So I think that really the answer to your question is that as our ability to detect cancers improves, as we can find them early, we can find them small, our ability with radiation to be able to deliver a very high dose to be able to control that cancer has skyrocketed. So I think it really comes back to prevention and detection of these cancers.
And it's not always used for cure. There's times when it's used in a palliative way, which maybe we want to briefly comment on. Then I have a couple of emails.
Yeah, you bet. It's also even used in some benign settings, say a keloid, overactive scar tissue that grows on a woman's earlobe after she has her ears pierced. It's a cosmetic thing, but can be a debilitating thing from a lifestyle standpoint. So there's benign applications of radiation. Palliative radiation, for me, is one of the most rewarding parts of my job. When people ask me what I do for a living and I tell them I'm an oncologist, almost always I get this, oh man, that must be so difficult. But, from my standpoint, I can't control that cancer is out there, that people are going to be diagnosed with cancer. It's very gratifying to be a part of providing a cure, quote unquote, to a patient, but it's also gratifying to be able to provide someone comfort at the end of their life from an aggressive cancer that we will not be able to cure. At our center, we have an integrated team of people, including a social worker, a naturopathic doctor, a nutritionist. This entire integrative care really focuses on the patient as an individual. And in a situation where, I know I can't cure a patient, but they have a tumor that's causing them pain, or it's bleeding, or it's, uncomfortable for whatever reason, to be able to deliver them a treatment that is really void of very many side effects and only really can give them a benefit is very gratifying to provide someone pain relief.
A question that came in by email is, please discuss when radiation is not useful or might be contraindicated, that is, not truly recommended.
That's so highly variable and individualized. There are certain cancers where radiation would not be needed. We've discussed that it's needed about two-thirds of cancer. But there are some cancers that are treated only with surgery or only with chemotherapy. But about two-thirds of cancers would need either a combination of surgery and radiation or a combination of surgery and chemotherapy or potentially all three.
There's another question regarding breast cancer radiation. So I've read news accounts of studies suggesting that the intensity of breast cancer radiation can be greatly reduced without reducing positive outcomes. Is this true or only speculative? My significant other suffered severe skin burns and degradation, I guess, of skin during radiation treatment in 2013.
Yeah, excellent question. So, the early days of breast cancer taught us a lot. 30 years ago, when we were delivering, radiation in a much more antiquated fashion, we thought that, for instance, low doses of radiation to the heart maybe didn't matter so much, because we didn't see any damage to the heart during radiation or even 2 or 3 years after radiation. But we know now, there was a a very important study published in 2012 in the New England Journal of Medicine. And it showed us that when you followed these patients who got radiation 20 or 30 years ago, and you look now at the incidence of heart disease many years after radiation exposure, it was increased directly proportional to the dose of radiation that went to the heart. So at Alaska Cancer Treatment Center, with application of the TrueBeam, we're the only center in Alaska that can offer a form of treatment called breath hold. And what that allows us to do is when a patient takes a deep breath, it brings the breast into the treatment field, but puts the heart further away. And by doing that, we're able to limit the dose that goes to the heart and thereby limit the risk of heart disease later in life. That's just one example of where modern technology has very real consequences.
So just to go over that again, that is a consequence of some breast cancer radiation therapy. The heart takes an inadvertent hit, so to speak, mm-hmm. which can have long-term complications. That has been recognized and now can be ameliorated to a large degree. So basically, the story of medicine is continuing to study outcomes and not accept whatever's going on as the status quo, and continuing to try to improve on it is basically what happens. It's not that we're always right. It's just that we're constantly looking to improve what we're doing.
Yeah, and sometimes these lessons, we don't learn them, for 10 or 20 years, right. And it's important to continue to ask those questions, not move on.
So along that same line, the last questioner had a comment at the end of their email, and it said, why do physicians seem to have a bias towards more instead of less treatment when a choice between two are presented?
You know, that's where I think it's one of the things we pride ourselves at Alaska Cancer Treatment Center is all patients are seen by everyone, typically on the same day and under one roof. So rather than kind of running all over town and seeing a surgical oncologist and a medical oncologist who, you know, might just have their own practice in mind, you actually have a team approach where doctors are sitting down, they're talking face-to-face about your care. I disagree slightly with that email in that, you know, the trend in medicine in general has been to go from, you know, more invasive to less invasive. You think of that in surgery, right, where we used to have really large incisions and now things are done laparoscopically or robotically, minimally invasive. And really it's the same with many of the technologies in cancer care, radiation being one of them. There's a real trend to shortening the duration of radiation treatments. What used to take weeks and weeks now maybe can be delivered in just a few treatments or maybe one calendar week. But I think that the most important aspect of cancer care is having a truly a team that is working together, making decisions together, providing options to a patient. And I think that really minimizes this recommendation of over-treatment, as the patient alluded to.
All right. Yeah, I would disagree with the comment as well, and I, not because I'm a physician, but because I think it is a misunderstanding of just science in general, and what you're constantly doing in medical science or pharmacological science or oncologic science is you're trying to improve on what you've done, and you don't want to undertreat a cancer mm-hmm. or anything, and so we obviously are going to start higher than we normally should, because we want to get a cure and we don't have somebody that relapses or has problems. And as we get better and better, we can, over time, show the studies that it's safer. But ethically, you don't want to start giving people something that's less unless you're sure it's more effective or safer or potentially both. That's how I look at this. And it may seem that way. But the overall answer is, what's the evidence? And once you have evidence that less is okay, then we're gonna move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always the evidence, and then how good the evidence is. I see in you, or I hear from you, much like what I hear from most cancer physicians. You're very involved. You're very empathetic. You are hopeful to help people, and that amazes me that you have followed up on that, not by just talking about it, but even as a resident in training, you started a nonprofit organization called Radiating Hope, which kind of moves in that same direction. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so my residency training was in Philadelphia, and I spent much of my residency training at an underserved hospital. We saw many uninsured patients or patients who were very much underinsured, some uneducated patients, and we'd see very advanced cancers, you know, some of which you'd have a hard time seeing, you know, even in developing countries. I was fortunate to be in a residency program with another physician who shared some of the same hobbies as me. I mentioned that I'm a mountain climber and preparing to climb Denali next month at the beginning of the show. My co-resident and I did a lot of mountain climbing together, and we decided that we wanted to do something positive with our mountain climbing efforts. And so we started carrying these Tibetan prayer flags with us on our mountain climbing trips in honor of our patients who were being treated for cancer. And basically what we would do is we would write their names on the flag, and we would take it with us in our backpack just as a gesture that we hadn't forgotten about them. And we would take a picture of their flag at the top of the mountain. And we were surprised at how meaningful a gesture this ended up being for many of our cancer patients. These Tibetan prayer flags carry some symbolic significance in that as they flap in the wind, the little threads on the flags as they're carried off are symbolic of prayers, of love, of warm thoughts for the person for which they're dedicated. We started to actually raise money through this prayer flag project, with the proceeds going to improve access to radiation oncology services in developing countries. We've branched out to accepting donations of used equipment here in the United States. Oftentimes, cancer centers will upgrade technology every few years, and they might have a cancer treatment machine that could be perfectly good used in a developing country. So, through our 501c3 Radiating Hope nonprofit, we're able to accept those equipment donations, you know, give the donating facility a tax deduction, and then also use this prayer flag project as a way for patients treated in the United States to sort of pass along a cure to patients who are in places like Africa or other underserved areas.
It's a really an interesting concept, and it's kind of interesting to learn about it. And if people want to know a little bit more, if you go to our website, alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link for today's program, you'll see some links to a very interesting video on the Mount Kilimanjaro climb, and also some videos with Dr. Doherty talking about the True Beam technology, which we've discussed a little bit, as well as some other reliable links about radiation therapy. I have a question here that says, does your organization accept Medicare patients? And let me broaden the question to not only do you accept Medicare patients, but tell us a little bit about Alaska Medical Specialties and the Alaska Cancer Treatment Center, which has its home within Alaska Medical Specialties.
Yeah, you bet. So coming here from the Mayo Clinic, where I was on staff and where I did much of my training, you know, I really was born of a mentality that that patients really like the approach of having all of their treatment done by a cohesive team, a cohesive unit that truly is working together, having much of their testing done under one roof, being able to get results quickly. And, you know, I was recruited here. I probably would not have come to Alaska if I didn't find a home that was very similar to what I was accustomed to at the Mayo Clinic. And at Alaska Cancer Treatment Center, you know, all of the doctors are on the same electronic medical record. You know, we meet face-to-face. Patients will come in and progress through a pathway where they see, you know, a surgical oncologist, a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, all at the same facility, all on the same day. For myself personally, I also really kind of like the fact that we're not at a hospital. We're located in Midtown. It doesn't have that kind of sterile feel that you might feel as an anxious cancer patient that's just been diagnosed. It feels more, you know, like a nice hotel or a nice executive building with nice artwork. And we've worked very hard to create a place where patients feel comfortable. We integrate for patients who are interested, you know, holistic approaches. We have a naturopathic oncologist on staff. We have a nutritionist to talk about nutrition and exercise. We have an oncology social worker. So it's really an integrated team approach to look at all aspects of cancer care, not just one.
And Medicare patients are
yes.
no problem.
Yes, we accept all major insurance companies, including Medicare and Medicaid.
How is a safe amount of medication of radiation determined? Kind of run us through that. Is this kind of an algorithm, a big computer program based on a bunch of facts that are thrown in, and you kind of know what to do, or more complex than that?
So when a patient is set to undergo radiation, the first step in that process after meeting with me is to undergo what's called a simulation. That's a planning visit for radiation. They lay down on a CAT scan table. We make a custom immobilization device. You know, if we were treating an area in the head, for instance, we would make a mask that conforms to the shape of a patient's face and their head. We'd get a CAT scan of the patient in that position of treatment, and it's really that CAT scan that I use to be able to tailor my radiation dose. So I can see the area that I want to treat. I can see all of the normal tissues. I can calculate how much radiation would go to each of those tissues as I safely deliver radiation to the area of the tumor. How is that determined? Much of that is based on data over the last 100 years. We know the different tolerances of each of the normal tissues in the human body. There is a body of literature called the Quantech dose constraints, which most radiation oncologists look to, that have established certain limits that we do not want to exceed for normal tissues. And with modern technology, we're able to most often be well below those thresholds. So we can deliver a high dose of radiation to the tumor while sparing the rest of the normal anatomy.
All right. We're in our last couple of minutes, and I got two questions. I'll let you take the one you want. You want to give us your final thoughts, what you want people to take away from this, or maybe a more political one is, where is cancer therapy going? It's no question you've convinced me that radiation oncology is really moving ahead in a very important way, but we also have immunotherapy. We have some other things we haven't talked about. So I'll let you take a couple minutes on either one or both short ones, however you want to handle that.
Yeah, you bet. No, both excellent questions. And I do think that cancer therapy is, by necessity, becoming much more individualized, much more tailored. That doesn't always mean tailored molecular drugs, though, which is, I think, what some folks might imagine. In fact, now, for instance, we have some forms of radiation that are tagged to antibodies, for instance, and the antibodies would escort a drug directly to a cell that has cancer and to deliver not only the drug but also localized radiation, right to the area that it needs to go. That was what much of my interest was in with brain cancer, was delivering radioimmunotherapy. So I do think that we are on a trajectory of delivering much more targeted, much more tailored therapies in the future.
Now, I said at the beginning of the program that the outlook for cancers are getting better, the treatments are getting better. There's a lot of reasons for this, maybe earlier recognition and less side effects. Are all of those comments true? I don't like saying things that are not true.
Oh, I think they're absolutely true. You look at, just in the short, relatively short amount of time that I've been a radiation oncologist, I started radiation oncology training in 2007. And from 2007 to 2015, looking at the dramatic revolution and the dramatic improvements in technology just in that short span of time, it really is mind-boggling what computers and different advances in technology have really allowed us to do. So I do think that we clearly are able to give a better treatment, more conformal treatment, a safer treatment, and a more effective treatment. I do think outcomes also are improving.
All right. My thanks to Dr. Larry Daugherty for taking the time. Thanks, Larry. This has been really educational.
Thank you for having me.
If you'd like to continue the conversation on radiation therapy of cancer, you can join KSKA on Facebook, and you can find that link at alaskapublic.org, where you also find our Line 1 archives. Also, you can take the time to let us know your thoughts and suggestions at that same address. Next week, Prentice Pemberton is going to host Line 1, and his guest is Olga Trujillo, She's an independent consultant, author, a renowned speaker, and an attorney, and she's dedicated to enhancing the understanding of violence against women and children. You'll understand a little bit more about that as she describes her traumas and battle with dissociative identity disorder. So why not join Prentice next Monday, April 27th? Pat Yak is Chief Content Officer at Alaska Public Media. Evan Erickson was our web editor today. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.